Okay. So what they said they could do is work at a numerical utility. If you could actually do the comparisons, then we can do numerical utility. This is how they went through it. They said the whole idea of having a non-numerical measure of something that's essential to a theory is a sign of how immature that theory is. And he said there's examples in history of pre-measurable concepts that later became measurable. So, for example, temperature. If back in the 17th century, you asked somebody how hot it was, they'd say, oh, really hot. Or moderately warm. Or rather cold. They wouldn't say 27 degrees. Okay? We didn't develop the idea of temperature until sometime later, in the 19th century. And they said what happened was we developed a way of measuring precise quantities of heat. Having first of all had the general concept of hot and cold and so on, at some point in history we developed the idea of energy and temperature. So they said a good theory goes from a ordinal ranking, hot and cold, to a cardinal ranking, 32 degrees and 15 degrees. And that's a sign of a good science. Saying that economics has stuck at this level of ordinal is the sign of an immature science. They said there's a way of working this out by taking the idea of a gamble with objective probability, not the subjective stuff, as I've shown you, that doesn't work. I never wanted to use that. But use the gambles with an objective, repeatable instance on chance and say, let's work out a numerical utility for you. Now, it has exactly the same problem of the curse of dimensionality, as I mentioned, for indifference curves in the first lecture. So it doesn't get around that. But as I mentioned, they were aware of that. They said, one may doubt. Now, notice this again. Some realism from genuine scientists. One may doubt whether a person can always decide which of two alternatives he prefers. Now, there's no sense of that uncertainty about measurement in economic theory because they haven't actually thought through the numbers. Von Neumann was a computer programmer, computer scientist. So his knowledge is far greater of computational issues than most economists. In fact, he's responsible for the invention of the computer. So he said, but even if that's so, you need completeness for both systems. So that's the flaw of both utility indifference curves, which the economists prefer to use, and the numerical stuff. So they say, let's leave that aside and see what happens. And they say, you can take some combination and say you prefer A to B or B to A like they did last time round. But if you say you prefer A to B, then the numerical value you give that utility will be higher than the numerical value you give to B. Transitivity will mean if A is preferred to B and B is preferred to C, as economists say, then the value of the utility of A will be higher than that of B and higher than that of C. Just like temperature, you know. 32 is not colder than 15. The cardinal ranking includes the ordinal ranking. And the basic idea is just choose some arbitrary value to begin with. So, for example, I'm going to say zero bananas give me zero utility. Sound reasonable? And then say one banana gives me one unit of utility. Then offer me a gamble, a repeated gamble, between zero bananas, or one banana for certain, pardon me, and two bananas with a certain level of odds. And when I'm willing to choose the gamble at a certain level of odds, the odds tell me the numerical value I put upon two bananas. So, for example, if you turn down the gamble, unless you get a second banana 70% of the time, rather than a single banana, then you can say the extra banana is adding 0.7 times the utility you got previously. So the utility of one banana is 0.7 times the utility of two bananas. So it works like this. The utility of one banana is one util. You make up a unit for measuring it. Then you accept a gamble between one for certain versus a 60% chance of two, or 40% of none. So one, if you choose it, one banana is giving you 60% of the utility of two bananas. So the utility of one banana is 0.6 times the utility of two bananas, and therefore the utility of two bananas is 1 divided by 0.6, or 1.67. So you've now got a numerical way of measuring the utility of more than one banana. And the marginal utility is 0.67, which is doing the same thing economists talk about of marginal utility falling as you have more units, but it's actually putting a numerical value upon it. keep on doing it. Do it with 2 for certain versus 0 or 3, 3 for certain versus 0 or 4, and so on. Work out the odds each time. Do that exercise as I've shown you for 1 to 2, and you can work out a numerical estimate of utility. Now, this is an example here. I won't go through it in great detail. This is mainly for your information. One of these days I might set a multiple choice question on it. But there's the exercise I've just been through a moment ago for the first banana. And you then say, well, 2 is worth 0.67. And then say, what odds do you choose to go beyond that for 3? We need a 78% chance of getting 3. So you then have to divide 1.67 by 0.78 to get the utility of 3 bananas, which is 2.141. And then you can say what the utility, the change utility there is 0.47. To actually take 3 bananas for sure versus odds of 4 or 0, you need 92% odds. You then divide the utility of 3 bananas by 0.92. You get the utility of 4 and so on. And what you can build is a numerical estimate of utility. Pretty swish, isn't it? Compared to all the nonsense you've done in micro so far, not bad. So it was supposed to be a replacement for the ordinary utility indifference curves. But instead, economists ignore the numerical completely, and you'll still say textbook saying you can't build a numerical scale for utility. Now, as von Neumann and Morgenstern have shown, if you can build indifference curves, then you can have a numerical measure. So the textbooks, again, don't know what they're talking about. Instead, they, ignoring that idea, they took the basic idea of expected return and expected utility with existing economic theory of indifference curves and so on, and develop what they call modern finance. And they had the vision of investors maximising non-numerical utility. Now, of all places where you want to have numerical utility, you think it would be when you apply this junk to the finance markets. So it would have been a good place to actually take on what they talk about, but they didn't do it. So what they did instead was put together all the stuff you've learnt in the other courses, Sharpe's catalytic pricing model, Modigliani-Miller's argument about dividends and relevance, Markowitz's risk-averse portfolios and so on, arbitrage pricing theory. It was called modern, by the way, because it was modern compared to the explanations of investor behaviour based on risk aversion by investors, riding herd behaviour versus fundamental trading and stuff like that, which was taught beforehand. Now, frankly, that's coming back in again. And the successful investors in the last 40 years have been the Warren Buffetts and so on, who ignored all this modern stuff and stuck with the old stuff. You'll find the stuff that Buffett did talked about by a guy called Gordon back in the 1920s. But initially, when it came out, it appeared to explain what conventional finance couldn't explain. Of course, 50 years later, now, it doesn't look so hot, does it? Well, let's go back and see where it started from. The foundation was a paper by a guy called Sharpe, William Sharpe, which gave us the capital asset pricing model. And he said the objective of the model was to predict the behaviour of capital markets. And the method was to take current theories about investment under certainty and extend them to conditions of risk. Now, of course, as I pointed out, that's not uncertainty. Okay? Risk is not uncertainty. And it's based on the idea of having an individual who maximises utility subject to a constraint, where utility is a positive function of the expected return and a negative function of the variability of that return, which is what they call risk. And the constraints are the available investments, the range of firms you can invest in, the returns you expect those companies to have, and the volatility of those returns as perceived by the individual investor. That's actually the budget constraint. Now, for example, I might say, well, I expect IBM's going to give me a 6% return for most of the indefinite future and a standard deviation of 3%. And it's going to have a correlation of minus 0.67 with CSR. So on that basis, I'll form my own portfolio, trying to maximise my returns and minimise my risks and so on. And that's how it all starts. Have you seen this diagram before? Anybody? Okay, but anybody who hasn't done a class with me? Not so many. Okay. This, if you read Sharpe's paper, which is one of the ones I've set, This is what you'll see. And he says, well, there is the utility surface people have. So you have increasing utility as you go up this way because you're getting a higher return with a lower volatility, hence the curve shape the other way to indifference curves for consumption. And the cloudy area is your range of potential investments. But there are three indifference curves. Those are investment opportunities. And only the fringe are like your budget line. I'm taking this stuff seriously for a while to take you through it. Of course, I don't take it seriously, but we'll get there. So those only X, C, D, and B, and F are worth looking at because of all the others you can get a higher return. So as you can see Z there, if you actually chose Z, you'd be putting up with a lower return than you could get from C for the same variability. Or you'd be having the same return as B but a higher volatility. And C is a trade-off between the two. So there's no point choosing Z. You choose somewhere along the line. And given the point of tangency here, that's the best combination for that particular investor. So Sharpe called this the investment opportunity curve. And he then showed that it reflects the correlation of separate investments. There are a couple of clever things in the paper, which is why I got the Nobel Prize for it. Being slightly clever gets you a Nobel Prize in economics. Being really clever gets you thrown out of the profession. Okay. So A is just a particular company. A might be IBM. And the expected return is the return of that company, and the volatility is the volatility of that company. B contains just B. Expected return is B. That might be CSR. Risk is the standard deviation of returns on B. C is some combination of the two. Now, if you put half your eggs in a BHP and half in CSR, your return's going to be 50-50 between the two. So your expected return is going to be a linear combination of the two investments' own expected returns. But the standard deviation is a whole mess more complicated. But that's going to be the volatility of each of the individual components, weighted by how much you purchased of them, including also the correlation. So that's the return expected from A, or the variance from A. That's the correlation of the return of A with the return of B. And you've got to include that factor in working out what your volatility of the whole portfolio is going to be. So the clever bit here is to say, well, let's say that R's 1, so they're perfectly correlated. I've got BHP and BHP effectively. Then it means that final term there has a 1 in it. And since that's 1, I can factor it out. And I now get the second expression without the RAB inside there. And that's easily factored into the square root of alpha times sigma A plus 1 minus alpha times sigma RB, all squared, square root of. It drops out as just a linear expression. So you have a straight line for your risk as well as a straight line for your return. And if you plot the two on a graph, you're going to get a straight line between them. So if they're perfectly correlated, that's what you get. Now, if on the other hand, there's no correlation, I could choose minus 1, for example, as well. In fact, I might set that as a multiple choice one day for the fun of it. There's the term again. Now, this is 0. So therefore, the whole final thing drops out. And notice they're all, they could be negative numbers in some case, but I took it where they were positive beforehand. So if I go from positive correlation to no correlation, that's a positive number. So when I drop that out, I've got this expression, and that's now going to be less than the square root of the previous expression, the straight line relationship. So your volatility is going to be lower for the combined portfolio. And that's really the cleverest thing you learnt in finance, that combining investments that don't have perfect correlations will give you a lower risk level, but also your total lower return. So that's the clever bit. So all those things along the curve there have to be portfolios where diversification has lowered your risk. So all the points on that investment opportunity curve are portfolios; they're not single investments. Now, the next thing Sharpe does is he assumes that there's some other asset you can invest in, like a government bond, that returns a pure interest rate with no variation at all. And he then says you can borrow as much as you like at that rate of interest, or lend. So we can all borrow and we can all lend an infinite amount of money, billions. If you wanted to buy BHP tomorrow, you could borrow the money for it. Everybody in this room would become BHP's owner tomorrow, according to the theory. So you can form a portfolio between P and any combination of goods of other investments you like. So you can move anywhere along a line that joins P with your ideal portfolio. And the way this works is that you have, here's your P, which is zero volatility, so it's down here. What's your ideal portfolio going to be? Well, it's now going to be a point of tangency between this line and that cloud of investment opportunities you perceive as an individual. Because otherwise, you're going to be getting a lower return. So that therefore means for everybody now, not just for the single investor, but for everybody, that is the ideal portfolio if they all have exactly the same expectations here. Think that's likely? Do you think it's what economists assumed? Yeah. Why the theory is nonsense. So he's got a theory of a single investor because that cloud is there. But really, as we know in reality, you can't all borrow the same huge amounts of money at the same rate of interest. I'll pay a lesser rate than most of you will. Jamie Packer will pay less than I do. Some of his colleagues may pay a bit more. And your expectations, the most important thing, of course, your expectations are going to be very different. So I might think IBM's going to return 6%. You might think IBM's going to go bankrupt. So if you look at where those shares lie for different investors, they're going to be different spots in a different cloud. So how do you go from a theory of a single investor to the market? And if you guessed it right, you assume they're all identical. Now, for that load of nonsense, it's time for a break for my voice as well. Another bit of a break, take about 10 minutes. Come back and I'll finish the lecture.